Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Lou Ann Mullen. Lou Ann, would you come here, please? Lou Ann is my collaborator in putting this program together with the Transition Network. Lou Ann is chair of the Bay Area chapter of the Transition Network, and I've been fortunate to work with her on several programs in the past few years here at the Commonwealth Club. I'm especially thankful that she's brought us Chris Farrell, the widely recognized author of Unretirement. I'll let Lou Ann introduce Chris Farrell.
Thank you. Thank you, John. I've really valued the relationship and collaboration we've had with John and the Commonwealth Club over the last several years and feel privileged to be able to work with him to bring speakers like Chris Farrell. So thank you. And for those of you who don't know about the Transition Network, it's an organization for women over 50, a national organization. There's chapters in about 14 cities, including here in the Bay Area. So grab us after Chris's presentation tonight, and we'll tell you more about it. Love to get you more involved. So I first met Chris Farrell a couple of years ago when he came here to the Bay Area to do some research on his book, Unretirement. And as many of you know, he's a well-known author. He's a journalist. He's a commentator on NPR. He's a contributor to several magazines, economy, business magazines. He's really a household name these days. And he's come all the way from Minnesota to be with us tonight to talk about his book, Unretirement, which is really a fabulous, fabulous book. And I hope you'll all read it, and there'll be copies available after tonight's performance. But he's looked at, you know, retirement and unretirement and looked at this era that we live in today and recognized that retirement as we've always known it doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work for the individual. It doesn't work for the society. That older people need to stay involved. Their wisdom, their knowledge, their experience is needed today more than ever. And society needs this group, this older generation, more than ever. So he's really taken a profound look at how critical it is that we, the older generation, stay involved. And if we don't, this society will really suffer. So he's done a great job of presenting the reasons, his observations, the statistics. And it's really quite an empowering an optimistic book, especially for those of us who are at this juncture of retirement now, and it will be for many of the generations to come. So it's a fabulous look at a very, very important topic. So please join me in welcoming Chris Farrell to the Commonwealth Club. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm honored to be here, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. And you were actually one of the first people that I introduced in when I was creating the book, and the Transition Network is a wonderful organization. It really is a terrific organization. And so one of the, as I did interview Lou Ann for the book, but in the back of my mind, I don't know if any of you had this, but when I was growing up, there were these three remarkable women in the background of our family: Aunt Ella, Aunt Julia, and Aunt Agnes. And they were nuns with the Sister of Charity of New York. And it's an order of nuns that deals with disadvantaged children. And part of what was so remarkable about them, you're 6 years old, and they really cared about what you thought. And plus, you know, they were nuns. I mean, they were kind of mysterious. They wore black habits, and they were just, you know, and they had these Irish-tinged New York accents. But one of them stood at Aunt Ella. And later on, I learned what an incredible career Aunt Ella had. So she got into college, she got her master's and her PhD from Fordham University. During World War II, she ran an orphanage in upstate New York. She worked at Mount St. Vincent. She was an administrator and taught mathematics there. She built parochial schools on Long Island. And she testified before Congress in the early 1970s in the successful effort to bring the nuns into the Social Security system. Now, the last time I saw Aunt Ella, she was at a nun's old age home, Convent of Mary the Queen in Yonkers, New York. And so I met with Aunt Ella, and as always, you walk the corridors, and you talk about family. and poverty and education, you know, these things that really mattered. But what's always stuck with me is when she signaled it was time for me to go. She said, "Chris, it's time for you to go. There's work to be done." And Ella was 96 years old. And that statement that she said to me has always stuck with me, and it's sort of, Aunt Ella in any era is a remarkable person, but her attitude, her approach over the next three decades is going to become commonplace. Now, we're having a national discussion about the aging of the population, and, you know, you can't listen to public radio, you can't open a newspaper, a magazine, where it's not talking about the aging of the population. Part of it has to do about the aging of the baby boomers, the 76 million born between 1946 and 1964. But even more important, we're living longer. So when Franklin Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act in 1935, average life expectancy, if you're rounding out the numbers, 62 years. Average life expectancy is now about 79 years. And by the way, it's good news that we're living longer, but you would never know it from the conversation that we're having nationally in the corridors of power in Washington, D.C., on the state level, a lot of corporations. It's the dire demographics of aging. I mean, as if Hunter S. Thompson hadn't written Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, it was Fear and Loathing about aging in America. And there's a couple reasons for this. I mean, part of it is we know, you know, boomers haven't saved that much. But much more important is there's a sense that, you know, older people, older workers, seniors, they're just not that innovative. They're not that creative. And we're just going to end up with too many old folks supported by too few young people. And so the new normal of the economy is going to be a slow growth, less dynamic economy. And a slow growth, less dynamic economy means that it's harder to pay the bills for Social Security and other old age programs. So the thesis of my book is that this is nonsense, that this is a deeply misplaced perspective on the aging of a population, and that it belongs to, you know, it's like your, you know, grandfather's Oldsmobile. It's perspective that belongs to a different society, a different economy. And instead, an aging population, the baby boomers and the ones that follow them, are going to offer the prospect of rejuvenating our communities and rejuvenating our economy. And what is most important about this is that, you know, many boomers want to be working. You know, you can look at the various surveys, right? And Merrill Lynch, AgeWave. AgeWave is a consulting firm, and they recently did a survey, and it was people working 50-plus, and 72% said they wanted to be working during the traditional retirement years. And there's lots of other surveys that are like that. You know, AARP has a survey that it does biannually, and it shows even higher numbers. And it's not just that people are saying that. The age of retirement, who has been falling for a long period of time, bottomed out in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And since then, the age of retirement has increased by about 2 years. Now, there are two different trajectories. One is men are retiring later. The other is more and more women coming into the paid labor force. And so, but both the trajectory is retiring later. And if you add in part-time work, the average age of retirement now is about 65, 66 years old, if you include part-time work. And there's a number of changes in our society and our economy that support people working longer. I mean, for one thing, we're better educated than before. And disabilities have gone down. Now, the improvements in disabilities, which was dramatic, has sort of stagnated. And yet, you know, you have to kind of think about how will technology affect the way we think about disability. I was at a conference recently, and I just hadn't thought about this. There was all this excitement about the driverless car. And how will the driverless car redefine disability? Because the excitement was people who are bound to their home or can't be driving all of a sudden may be able to go to work or at least be able to go out at night and go to the movies or whatever. So disability, I think, is a moving target, but we are definitely a better aging population. We're also in an economy that's dominated by services and information technologies. So it was one thing if we'd be having this conversation when the dominant heights of the economy, 1950s, 1960s, was smokestack America. I mean, the factory work and mining and fishing and farming. But now it's information technologies, it's services. It's a lot easier to work in a medical diagnostics office than it is to work in a coal mine. work is also a social institution, and I think this is something that we're appreciating more and more. I mean, when you're at work, you know, people celebrate when someone has a baby. They help people get through a divorce. You know, there are people you dislike. You gossip. There's all kinds of things going on. And, you know, it's a community. And, you know, the people that you don't like are just as important as the people that you do like in this community, because you don't like everybody. And when they do the surveys, people who have retired, what do you most miss? What do you miss from not working? Top of the list is always their colleagues, the people that they met, the suppliers, the vendors, whatever the kind of work they were doing. Money's on the list, but it's way down. The other thing is there's something very odd about the notion of retirement. And remember, retirement means that you stop working. You say goodbye to your colleagues for the last time, and you stop working. And what is very strange is, despite all the ups and downs in a career, over that time you've gained skill. You gained knowledge. You gained experience. And now all of a sudden you're going to walk away from that for the rest of your life. And most people are turning out, they don't want to walk away from that knowledge, that skill, that experience. Now, they don't want to be working 40, 50 hours a week. They want more part-time work. They want more flexibility in their lives. But they want to be useful. And they want to offer meaning. And so who we are and what we are, a big part of it, is what we learned over the years. And so I think we've increasingly appreciated that we want to still work, just not the same amount of time. So what kind of work will it be? I mean, is it part-time work? Is it flexible work? Is it temp work? Is it contract work? Starting your own business? Another full-time job? I mean, there's an enormous experimentation going on. And I don't know if you remember that Buffalo Springfield song, For What It's Worth, you know, the famous lyric. And I have a microphone here, and I could sing it to you. But I'm not going to, because I have some friends in the audience and they know what I sound like when I sing. But something's happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. It's an experimentation. Joseph Coughlin, he's the absolutely infectious head of the MIT Age Lab. And I think he's got the right expression. He calls it the Baby Boomer Retirement Improv Act. And if you've ever done improv, you know how scary that can be. But it is an improv act. And, you know, as part of this improv, I think a lot of times in economics and finance or personal finance, we underestimate the power and the importance of stories. So Deirdre McCloskey is a great economic historian. And she says that economists are tellers of tales and makers of poetry. Now, I've read a lot of economic studies over the years. There's no poetry there. I'll go along with the tellers of tales, but not the poetry part. But think about, you know, when I say you're going to be working longer, or we're going to be rethinking on retirement. You know, one image that we have, and it's a powerful image for most of American history, for most of history, what people did is they worked until they died. And so there's this image of you're just going to have to work until you die. And then there's this remarkable period of our history in the post-World War II era, thanks to the Social Security Act in 1935, Medicare in 1965, embrace of defined benefit pension plans by a lot of companies, and really, most importantly, this economic boom, the golden era of U.S. economic growth, that people were able to leave work, and for the first time, leisure could be embraced by large parts of society, moved to Arizona, moved to Sun City, moved to California, moved to Florida, and they would retire. And yet, as we've gradually learned over time, that has limited appeal. And I was in a multi-generational community that's being built on the other side from Sun City in Phoenix called Vareto. And was talking to this guy, and he said, look, here's the thing, Chris. Here's what it is. It's 4:30 in the afternoon. You're on the patio. You're having a drink. You've retired. It is so wonderful. You're not worried about being fired. You're not worried about who you're going to hire. You're not worried about a budget or a meeting. You just relax. And you have a drink at 3:30 in the afternoon. Feel a little strange. You realize no one really cares that I'm having a drink at 3:30 in the afternoon. Then you have a drink at 1:30 in the afternoon, and you know it's time to go back to work. So I think that these stories are going to become increasingly important. And part of this story is also for all of us. I mean, think about it. Whoever you are, you want meaning in your life. And so part of the search for unretirement or encore, second act, third stage, is a search not just for an income, but it's also a search for meaning. And part of the income part is extremely important. Because we know a lot of people have not saved enough to be living for 20, 30 years off their savings, even if they wanted to do that. And I think the changes in our society is most people don't want to do that. But the personal finance of continuing to work is quite powerful. I mean, for one thing, what most people can earn, earning a slim part-time income, dwarfs whatever they're going to make off of their savings. You know, even in the best year, for those of you who have a 401k or a 403b or a 457, I mean, take a look. 2014 was an incredible year. But even just earning a little bit of money in a part-time job will dwarf whatever you made for most of you, I would bet. The other thing is your money can continue to compound. It can continue to grow. Or if you tap into it, you're tapping into it less. The third reason is it allows you to file for Social Security later. And for the typical person, for the median worker, the single most important decision that they can make when it comes to retirement is delaying Social Security. Because the benefit at age 70 versus age 62 is more than 75% higher. And so taking these all together, Robert Shackleton, he's an economist at the Congressional Budget Office. And in 2004, he did this calculation. So you have a two-income couple, and they make a household income of $100,000. If they're retired and use your sort of benchmark for personal finance, which is that you want 80% of your income in your retirement years from what you earned before retirement, because you're not taking the dry cleaning in, your taxes are going to be less. So there's a variety of reasons why you don't need to earn the same amount of money. So in order to maintain their standard living in retirement, if they file for Social Security at age 62, they need a portfolio of about $890,000. So that's where you get that number that gets tossed out there. You need a portfolio of $1 million. And what they're using, by the way, are the Social Security average life expectancy tables, because you have to have an endpoint there at some point. Now, if they work until their full retirement age, which is age 66, they need a portfolio of $550,000. If they work to age 70 and file for Social Security, they need a portfolio of $260,000 to maintain their standard of living in retirement. So the economic effect, the personal household effect of working longer is actually quite powerful. And so, you know, that part of it, but also then, I do believe there is this search for meaning, this search for work. You know, one of the things that struck me when I was doing the interviews is how similar are 20-somethings and 60-somethings. You know, when a young person, and looking at this crowd, most of you have probably been approached by somebody, they've graduated from college, they're trying to figure out, what kind of job, what kind of career should I be doing? And, you know, one of the things that always has struck me is they have some ideas. They do not want to be living in your basement. They really don't want to be living in your basement. They want to be earning an income, but they also want to do something that they feel good about, something that they feel proud about. And we support that, and we encourage them to do that. When you're talking to someone 60-something, who's looking for an encore, who's looking for something next to do next, it's the exact same conversation. They want to be earning an income. They need to be earning an income. But they also want to do something that they feel good about, something that they believe will make a difference, that will leave a legacy. And the only difference between the 60-something and the 20-something is that the 60-something knows that time is short, and the 20-something thinks time is infinity. Now, part of this, I think a lot of the jobs that people are going to be doing are in the service sector, health, education, involving computers. And typically what people are going to do is take their skills and go probably to a different part of the economy. And there was a wonderful article in the Harvard Business Review by Mark Friedman, who's the founder of Encore.org, an organization, an important organization in this whole movement here based in the Bay Area. And, you know, what he criticized, and he was so right, is there is this strand of conversation that's going on about reinvention. So you've worked in a cubicle all your life, or you're a corporate road warrior. And, you know, you go up to Napa Valley, and you're having some wine, and you kind of think of, boy, wouldn't this be cool? I bet you could make a really organic, sustainable wine if you did this. A couple of venture capitalists are sitting next to you. They say, I think that's a great idea. We're going to invest in you. Here's a couple $1 million. And then so you build your winery, and the next thing you know, Richard Branson is only going to serve your wine on his airline. And then Bill Clinton calls up and says, come on, you got to come to the Global Initiative and tell how you go from the cubicle to the winery. Now, that may happen. I don't know. Maybe. We can always hope, right? But for most people, It's not about reinventing. It's just about taking your existing skills, your knowledge. You were in communications. You were in finance. Whatever it is that you had, but moving to another sector of the economy, because then there's a certain energy that comes from a different sector of the economy. You have different missions. You have different people. You have different challenges. But you also get the reassurance that you're tapping into what you know. And you actually, that helps you be useful. And all of us, at any stage of our lives, want to be useful. The other thing that we're seeing, and is happening, is in the numbers, and it's going to grow, is that more and more people are starting their own business. So in 2013, 23% of all new businesses were started by the 54 to 64-year age group. Now, everyone thinks, you know, new business, that's Mark Zuckerberg. I know I'm in the temples of Mark Zuckerberg in this area and Jack Dorsey of Twitter and everything. But 23% of all new businesses is the 55 to 64-year age group. Now, some of that is because you have no choice. You're 55 years old, you're 56 years old, you're laid off, and, you know, you can't get another job. And so, but you have skill, you have knowledge, your experience, you start your own business. Part of it is this knowledge that you're getting older. You've had this dream. You've had this idea. You're going to go start a company. You would at least have an idea. Or as many of people that I know that are starting a company, they don't want to report to anybody. They're tired of do more with less. And they know some good people, and they like working with them informally. And so they start their own business. And I expect that this will continue to grow because it was 23% in 2013, and that's up from 14% in 1996. So more and more of this entrepreneurship is an exciting part of our economy. And I think over the next three decades, what we're going to see, more people doing, a lot of it's going to be Schedule C businesses. It's going to be self-employment, maybe a couple of part-time employees at most probably working with some informal partnerships or formal partnerships. But nevertheless, it's entrepreneurship, and it's entrepreneurial, and it brings in some income. And often you're doing stuff that you like, and you're working with people that you like. And you can do it for a considerably long period of time. Self-employment retirement rates are the age of retirement and self-employment is a lot older than people who are employees. Now, a big part of what is going to happen here, though, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, is breaking down a lot of barriers to people working longer. And there are some real stereotypes out there. And most of them have to do with that, you know, seniors, they're not that creative. They're just not that creative. You know, hey, if we want someone reliable, we'll hire someone with white hair. But we want someone who's creative. We don't want that person in the door. And I think this is one of the most pernicious stereotypes in our society. And fairly recently in February 10th, flew out to New York, and I went to the Museum of Modern Art to Matisse exhibit. And it was Matisse's cutouts. I don't know if you've ever seen them. They're just incredible. And Matisse did the cutouts, which is considered the height of his career and the height of his creativity, from about age 74 to age 84 when he died. Much of it done from a wheelchair, much of it done from a bed. And yet here he was, incredibly creative. And the thing is, when you start going through artists, you find out there are more and more artists that did their most creative work in their 50s, and then their 60s, and then their 70s. And the same thing's true with novelists. And there's this thing out there that we see a young person do something that's really extraordinary, you know, we say, ah, that's a genius. We see somebody who's a senior do something extraordinary, we say, boy, isn't that remarkable? But the thing is, no one's really added up how many remarkables there are. So two stories. One comes from the Harvard Business Review, and it's BMW, global manufacturer of expensive automobiles. And Germany has an older population than the U.S., so BMW decided, you know what we're going to do is we're going to create the pensioners line. We're going to see what our workforce like is in the future. And so they manned an assembly line with older workers that would match the demographics down the road. And the initial productivity of that assembly line was far less than the productivity of its other assembly lines. So then they invested in yoga, meditation, different flooring, bigger screens, different chairs, more comfortable shoes, so a total of $50,000. So what's that going to get you? One BMW. $50,000. The productivity of that assembly line now matches the productivity of the other assembly lines in Germany. And the lessons that it learned from working on that assembly line are now being spread throughout its assembly lines around the world because, you know, put it bluntly, if a young person can work through the pain of hurting their back, why do you want them to hurt their back? And if yoga can help people be more productive, then why not invest in some yoga? The other one is a company called Your Encore, which is based out of Indianapolis. And Procter & Gamble, Eli Lilly, joined pretty quickly by Boeing. And they have people who are retiring. And they're creative and they're skilled. And if you think about what major multinational corporations are trying to do today, they're trying to keep their labor force fairly stable. So it's one reason why we've had this long economic recovery and you don't see a lot of really big hiring going on is that companies are very wary to hire because what they're trying to do is avoid laying off a lot of people when the bad times come, which is inevitable. But what that means is when an opportunity comes along or there's a problem, it's really hard to find bodies and minds to deal with it. So what this consultant did is he created for P&G and Eli Lilly and other companies a database of their retired research scientists, retired marketers, retired communications people, whatever they were. And then if you're a manager at P&G and you got an opportunity or you have a challenge, you can hire these people. And the consulting firm deals with all the payments and the Social Security and the withdrawals and all that kind of thing. And what's really striking in talking to the managers is there is this refrain. How creative these old retired people are. They're incredibly creative. So then you talk to the older retired people. You say, hey, you old retired person, why are you so creative? And they said, look, here's the deal, Chris. We go in to solve a problem. We're not worried about where company is going to put its capital next year. We're not worried about whether or not our division is going to be lopped off. Corporate politics takes up a lot of our bandwidth. We're not worried about corporate politics anymore. We're now doing what we got into the business in the first place, which was to solve a problem. So we're incredibly creative, and then we go back to the golf course until we get the next call. And so I think this is an incredibly positive way to be looking at things and be able to take advantage of a workforce. And we're starting to see more and more. Blue Cross Blue Shield now has a similar program, which is outsourced to Kelly Services. So again, Kelly Services deals with all the back office stuff, the payments. But if you're a Blue Cross Blue Shield manager and you want somebody extra help, that you tap into these retirees, the retirees make some money. When the project's done, they leave. And so this is part of what this breaking down the stereotype is going to happen. It's also going to have some real implications for how we think about planning for retirement or thinking about retirement. Because if you think about the last couple of decades, we have had a conversation about retirement that has been dominated by mutual funds, asset allocation, diversification. How much can I withdraw every year? I mean, it's been a very financially oriented discussion. When you think about unretirement, it changes the focus of what is your question. So the main question of the past three decades has been, what is my number? What is the number, what's the savings that I need to have in order to be able to maintain my standard of living during retirement? The new question is, what do I want to do next? Now, by the way, savings is important. Don't get me wrong. But the question is, what do I want to do next? And it turns out that that is not always easy to figure out because you also... you want to do something that makes a difference. You want to do something that you feel good about. And what is it I want to do next? And so therefore, your most valuable asset becomes your network and the people that you know and your colleagues and the people that you can talk to about what is it that I want to do next. And I had a wonderful conversation years ago that stuck in my mind with Jake Warner. And some of you may know him. Jake Warner founded NOLO.com, which is a self-help legal organization. And, he said he's very involved in nonprofit organizations in the environmental area. And he told me this story. He said, Chris, we have these wonderful people. Yeah, they're 65, 75 years old. And they show up at our door and they say, I really care about the environment. I want to help. And we welcome them. We love them. They're great. This is wonderful. We don't really know them. But, they volunteer. So then we have other people. 55, 60, they're going to retire 5 years, 10 years, and they start really volunteering. And we get to know them. And by the time they're nearing the age of retirement, we are begging them to retire because we know exactly who they are. We know exactly what they can do, and our organization needs them. And so I think, networking, thinking through about what you want to do next, volunteering, learning about what it is that may tap into your skills but allow for flexibility, that this is the core issue for many people as we think about retirement. It's also going to become, over the next three decades, a major factor in corporate benefits. this notion of a second career, a third career, helping people make the transition, particularly among companies that have 401k plans and offer their employees 401k plans, which, by the way, one of the biggest disgraces in the United States is that 42% of private sector workers do not have an employer-sponsored retirement savings plan at work. And so whenever people criticize people for not saving enough for their retirement, when you look at the aggregate statistics, actually people aren't doing that bad. It's the 42% who don't have access to retirement savings plan at work that are struggling the most, and as they should be struggling the most because it's not easy to do. And, yes, you can go set up an IRA, but, I mean, seriously. So we have some systemic faults that are in our society, not so much that people have individual failings. But nonetheless, you have companies like Intel. And, you know, they've set up programs on core fellowships. And so you're an employee at Intel. You're nearing those retirement years. You think you want to move to the nonprofit sector. And there's a matchmaking that goes on with the employee to find the right nonprofit. And then there's also a stipend, which helps make for the transition. And you're seeing programs like this in IBM, Cisco, Hewlett-Packard, and Herman Miller up in Zealand, you know, the large office maker. Now, one of the things you notice about all these companies is they deal with relatively low rates of unemployment. They're in markets where there's a lot of competition for labor. And so, you know, they're at the pioneers. They've had a good reason to do this. I think as the unemployment rate continues to drop, I think as the economy continues to grow, what I'm noticing is that more and more human resources departments are taking this seriously. They've done a lot of conversations over the years. But now they're starting thinking, we got to do something. What is it we want to do? And so they're turning to the Intels and the IBMs and trying to learn from their program. The most important program, in one sense, is happening right now, which is at the level of the federal government. So the federal government has instituted a phased retirement program. Now, the rules were set back in November 2014, and now in 2015 and 2016, the individual departments will come up with their own twists. But the way it's basically set up is you're going to be able to withdraw, you're going to work 20 hours a week. You can withdraw partially on your pension. And during that 20 hours a week that you work, you agree to mentor 20% of your time. Now, the thing is, the federal government has had a very large impact on corporate benefits. If you look at the history of corporate benefits, a lot of times the federal government is taking the lead, and then companies modify it or adapt it. So I think if the federal government's phased retirement program succeeds, what we're going to see is that's going to be a real spur to a lot of private sector companies, more and more private sector companies, to embrace that kind of work. And I think that will be particularly exciting. And one of the most important things, and really the note that I want to leave this on, is there's a terrible conversation in our society about intergenerational conflict. It's one of the biggest nonsenses I've ever read or heard about, that somehow the younger generation and the older generation are at odds with each other, and there's a world of scarce resources. And I think it's a very different story. It's a story about the generations are united, and it's united in terms of seeking work, seeking meaning. And one of the things that's really exciting about this period of experimentation that we're going through is that what experimentation means, and any of you who have been in an environment where you've done experiments, they don't always work out. But the real beneficiary of this period of experimentation is not the baby boomers. The real beneficiary is the younger generation. It's my 22-year-old. Because by the time my 22-year-old is in his 50s and 60s, we're going to have a very different expectation of the last third of life. We're also going to have very different institutions. We're going to have different perspectives on how you enter into the workforce and how you lead the workforce. And I think one of the most exciting things is that if you're going to be working over a longer period of time, it opens up the prospect for the younger generation of a lot more experimentation, a lot more moving in and out of the workforce, different careers, different jobs. And so the experimentation that we're going through is going to be difficult. It isn't going to work out for a lot of people, but that is the process of learning. And then more of the younger generation, as we get phased retirement programs become instituted, as Encore Fellows becomes more instituted and more commonplace, that as these things become institutionalized, the younger generation is going to have a lot more options and a lot more choice, and they're going to have a completely different vision of what the last third of life is like and should be like and what they want it to be like compared to previous generations. So I still hope you buy the book. But that's the basic thesis. And now I think we're going to go for some questions, which I always enjoy, and brickbats, challenges, elaborations.
Chris, have a drink here.
Thank you.
I'd like to remind our listening audience, this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Chris Farrell with Unretirement. Thank you, Chris. And now it is time for questions. We have a mic that we can pass around if you have a question for Chris. We'd like to make it available, and I see one here in the front.
Chris, you... this better? Sorry.
It was a searing question.
Yeah, well, yes. I wanted all the attention I got. You know, you talk about how critical it is that our generation does stay involved because society needs us. Is there going to be a real dearth of employees once all the baby boomers really do start retiring? Are there enough workers to fill our places? And if not, are employers recognizing that? I mean, is that an issue that we really need to inform employers about that, you know, wait a minute, you better hold on to who you have because there's no one to replace them? Or is that not necessarily true? There's plenty to follow in our footsteps.
There's sort of like different layers, and depending on the industry, so industries that are more knowledge intensive, that have a higher educated workforce, they're absolutely obsessed about this question, and they have lots of conferences and a lot of conversations. So, for example, the federal government has one of the oldest workforces in the country, and it's also a highly educated workforce. And they've done the calculations that if actually the federal workforce decides we're going to retire, it will cause enormous problems, which is why the phased retirement program is coming in, and it was a bipartisan support behind it, is to prevent that kind of an exodus and all the disruptions. But then there are other industries, more retail industries, a lot less concerned about it, not exactly on their radar screen. I think a lot of it has to do with we're now just at the part where demographics is going to feed into companies wanting to keep workers longer. And so it's a conversation that, as I said earlier, that's moving from the abstract into what do we need to do about it. And there is greater recognition that, first of all, more and more people want employment. Secondly, that we don't want to be losing all these workers. Now, on the other hand, there's a fear by younger workers. Well, great, you're going to have a job. So I'm not going to get a wage increase. I'm not going to get a promotion. And why don't you leave? And that is a fear that's very haunting. Now, this is something that economists study a lot, and they feel that it's a very strong fallacy that on the economy wide that it's a zero sum game. That if you have more older employees, you have fewer younger employees. And actually, what the data shows that if you have job growth among older employees, you also have job growth among younger employees. And if you don't have job growth among older employees, you don't among younger. I mean, basically, it makes sense. We're all in the same boat. But the other things, they also think that in terms of opening up the pipeline, you know, what a lot of people are going to do is they're going to leave. And they're going to try something different. And they're going to try and set up their own business. Or they might move to a different sector of the economy, say from the for-profit to the not-for-profit sector of the economy. So we do have this image of the economy as a zero-sum game. I think it's a positive-sum game. And actually, if one way of looking at it is, and go back and read the op-ed pages in the 1980s, early 1980s, and there was lots of op-eds. Okay, so there's going to be more women going in the workforce. That means there's less jobs for men. Now, what happened is we grew the pie. We expanded the pie, and there's still farther to go, but the fact is the pie grew, and both benefited, both men and women, from the influx of women into the workforce. And so I think it's going to be the same thing. But what is amazing is the creativity people have and the kind of jobs that they come up with. And if you just have an image of a job as something that you walk in a door, you hand in a resume, and then you're going to get a cubicle or you're going to be on a factory floor, then you can come pretty easily up to a scenario where there aren't going to be a lot of jobs. But yet this is an incredibly creative economy. There's a lots of kinds of jobs. And so I that part of it doesn't really worry me that much. I actually, though, do believe that companies are all of a sudden going to wake up one day and realize that, you know what, we demanded do less with more for too long, and all the experience and all the knowledge and all the skill is going out the door, and then they're going to come back in and they're going to charge us more for doing what we were paying them.
Hi. Great talk. Can't wait to read your book.
Thank you.
So you talked about how we're healthier, we're living longer, and therefore we're going back to doing something else or going into the private sector or whatever. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of the corollary effect? In other words, those who go back into the workforce or into doing something else with purpose, as you mentioned, live longer or are healthier.
Right. So this is one of those things that always bedevils scholars. You know, what's is it healthier people work longer, or is it working longer mean that you become healthier? And the research, and particularly there's some really interesting research coming out of Britain, an organization called Nesta, which if you put that into your search engine, that will kind of be a window into some really interesting research in this area. It's a lot of really good research in the whole rethinking third act of life. And they make pretty convincing cases, and more people are agreeing that it's not just the healthier working longer, but actually working longer makes you healthier. And one way to think about it is, in order to get to work, you have to do some movement. And then you're around people, and you have to, you know, respond to them. And yet, so there's all these games that are being created so for seniors, you know, to keep their mind active. Well, all you have to do is sit at if you work with computers, is, you know, companies, they change that computer program every 6 months and you got to learn something new. Well, you get frustrated, but the fact is, it's much better than a video game. And the same thing with talking to colleagues. And so there is this strong sense that because you're moving, you're using your eyes, you're talking, you're learning new computer systems, whatever it is that you're doing, but most importantly, you're engaged. Because what it really hurts seniors and what really damages their health is isolation. And the more isolated you are, it is very clear the greater risk of depression, the greater risk of not being as physically mobile. So it's one of those things you can't correlation, causation, you have to be wary. But the research, and I think common sense, points you in the direction that it's not just the healthier working longer, but working longer keeps you healthier.
Thank you. Thank you for having this. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
What a perfect segue to Mr. Jacobson's, because I think what you didn't mention is the field of neuroscience, which you actually just addressed.
Yes.
I'm a nurse. I was triaging for 37, 40 years in the emergency room. And everything you say is so pertinent because of the brain. And we wouldn't even be having this discussion, would we, without knowing what we know now about neuroscience.
Yes.
And what we know about what makes the brain happy. And we're like infants at age 65. There's no way we can learn four languages if we wanted to. So anyway, this is very exciting. And I wanted what you might say about neuroscience.
Well, I think that one of the things that, you know, neuroscience is one of those fast-moving fields. And what they thought in neuroscience 5 years ago compared to today, compared to what they're going to know five years from now. In neuroscience, we know a lot of things that are happening, and we have kind of explanations, but we're not always too sure. But the one thing that in neuroscience that they do know really well is that the older image that the brain decayed, and the older image that the brain couldn't be renewed and there wasn't growth going on, you know, that image is truly wrong. And that the neuroscience basically supports what we're talking about, and it supports this conversation. The actual ins and outs, I actually think at a lot of neuroscience at the core, there's some really smart people who have uncovered just absolutely brilliant insights, and they think this is what it may mean. But I think in terms of for us, as a more mass audience, what neuroscience really says is that this conversation we're having and the issue that you're raising in terms of does working more, staying in the workplace, does that help your health? The neuroscience supports that we may not have a direct line from the neuroscience into a lot of this, but boy, it sure supports that perspective.
One pie that doesn't grow is the physical limitations of the land and the planet. And what's going on now, in particularly in the Bay Area, is that people are our age are being more active, they're living longer, and they're more active to stay in their houses longer because they're not going to retirement homes. They can stay in their houses longer. And kids or young kids are having very difficult times getting into the buying into the houses, and it's changing the demographics of communities very dramatically, from what I'm seeing. You get these, you know, you get communities that are younger people where they can't buy, and then the older people stay in their houses. So that's an issue that is tricky. So how do you address that?
So there's a couple things there. I think you're absolutely right. Now, I have a slightly more positive take on people aging in place, because you're absolutely right. Aging in place is a big deal. And if you do surveys, the numbers are always extremely, extremely high that people don't want to move out of their homes. They like to stay there. Now, I think that perspective is actually going to increase because of unretirement. Because it's the most valuable asset that somebody has is their network. And if you think about that, there's a cottage industry of scholars, and more than 50% of all jobs come from a network. You know, third degree of separation, fourth degree of separation. So if you pick up and you move to a different part of the country, unless you have a lot of wealth and they live in a different world, you've left behind your most valuable asset, which is your network. And just as an aside, the valuable asset, this doesn't have to do with work, but when my dad retired at age 74, he always used small, independently owned businesses. And then he went to every independently small business that he went to, and he said, I retired, what are you going to do for me? And everyone cut him a 20% deal. So it was really incredible. I was embarrassed. I said, you did? He says, yeah, what are you going to do? But this is also that people are doing the same thing. And he knew some people, they've been a good customer for 20 years at the Ace Hardware store, and they go walk in the Ace Hardware store and said, I've retired, do you want to hire me? And these options exist when you have your network. So I think that's a positive thing. On the housing market side, I think there are two things that are going on. We have a tax system that overly rewards housing. So that is truly there. But because of the recent experience, there's a greater appreciation of renting. So I think it's going to be a slightly different balance between the rental market and the home ownership market going forward. More importantly, when you look at Pew Research has the data, it's from, I think, a year or two ago, but the multi-generational housing went way down. But again, that also bottomed out in the 1980s, and since then has grown quite dramatically. And this is about a couple of months ago when I was reading the earnings call-in that Lennar, the home builder, and they had with the Wall Street analysts. And it was a small percentage of their business, but it was the fastest growing part of its business was multi-generational homes. And so what I actually think we're going to see is a return to multi-generational homes, which to my parents' generation would have been a nightmare. But that's a world of one bathroom and four bedrooms. Now homes are much bigger. They can be divided differently. And so my suspicion is, in the endless creativity of people, they're going to be turning into a lot more multi-generational homes, and that's going to be one of the ways, shared equity, that you'll deal with that issue. But you can't minimize. If you're living in the Bay Area, you're living in New York, you're living in Washington, D.C., it's a very different story than if you're living in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis or St. Paul, or Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Salt Lake City.
Thank you. I hope I can make this into a question, but I retired a year ago, and I hate the term because it sounds dead when you say you're retired. And so I consulted with a cat who's a coach, about how do I get what I want. Well, so now a year later, I volunteer, I consult, time with my family, but all my acquaintances and friends in my network always want to know, they say, well, what do you do? And I am so tired of that question.
Yes.
Because they're never satisfied with the answer. I feel like I'm justifying breathing. So my question to you is, I wonder, is there a name out there you can use to describe what this is? And also, is there an expectation in our networks that we should keep working and we should...
Yeah. So I got a couple of things on this. So one, in the book, one of the Mr. Kaufman that I profile, and he sort of had a different career every 10 years. So he's a truck driver for 10 years, he's a welder for 10 years, and then for longer than 10 years, he was a Mennonite minister. And then he was, it was 65 or whatever, it was time for him to retire. But he was doing something along what you're doing. He decided that when he retired, what he was going to do is work for money 3 days, work on the home 2 days, and then volunteer the rest of the time. And that was what he was doing. So he hadn't kind of figured it out. He was driving one of those medivans, and you make $11 an hour. And he really liked the people, but it wasn't quite satisfying. He was working on the home. But he said the exact same. He'd go to a cocktail party or a dinner party, and people would say, "What are you doing?" And he tried to explain it to them, and their eyes would glaze over. So what he decided, he'd just say, "I'm retired." And everyone would go, "Oh, okay." And they just assumed that he wasn't doing anything. So I want to try out a term for you. I don't think it's quite right. But if you think about, we'd all like to go on a sabbatical, but we can't afford it. I mean, there are certain professions like professors, right? They get sabbaticals every 7 years or something like that. We'd all like to do a sabbatical. What I think retirement has turned into is actually a sabbatical. Because if you look at what people are doing, they're stopping working. What the data shows is that within 2 years, they've really found a different, you know, they found like what you're doing, but it's different things to do. And so retirement is really taking time off. It's a sabbatical. It's a long vacation. There's a study by two economists at the RAND Corporation, and that's what they defined retirement as. It turns out retirement's a long vacation. I like the term sabbatical. And then people kind of figure out what it is they want to do. And part of it is, if we think about our organizations that many of us probably work in, organizations have a set of expectations and a set of rewards. Oh, that's a smart thing to do. Oh, why would you do that? That's stupid. And so one of the reasons people retire is you have to get away from that. What is it you want to be doing? What's smart to you? What do you think is stupid? Not what does the boss or your managers or your colleagues or your professional colleagues. And so that's why I still think that what retirement has become is a time of decompression, it's a time of vacation, it's a sabbatical. And in the end, even though I talk a lot about work and continuing to earn income, because I think for a lot of people that provides validation, I think it's important. In the end, it's all about being engaged. It's about being engaged in what you're doing. And if whether someone pays you or doesn't pay you is less important than that you're engaged. But the one thing that's been interesting in talking to people in the nonprofit world is what they have learned is even if you pay a professional, so a lawyer makes $300 an hour, and now he's working with one of these nonprofits where you're providing your services at a very low cost, $15 an hour, and that's actually right, $15 an hour. The thing is, if you're paying it, you're paying even a stipend, the person shows up, and the agency or the business takes you seriously. And now I think I'm getting the hook.
Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We really appreciate your comments here today. And I notice your books are in the back, so I'm wondering if you'll stay and sign books and answer questions for the audience afterwards.
I'd love to.
Would you?
Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you. I'd also like to say that there's a slip of paper in your chair. We've had a number of people with interest in a continuing discussion here at the club on the intersection of aging and technology, because a lot of people do want to continue to live at home. So if you'd like to be part of that conversation, just fill out the slip, put your name and email, and we'll be in touch and tell you when it meets again. All right? And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 112th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.